Welcome to the Wellness Mama podcast. I'm Katie from wellnessmama.com. A random fact, did you know that fasting is an age-old remedy that has been around since even before biblical times? In fact, Plato was famous for saying, "I fast for greater physical and mental efficiency." And today's guest knows quite a bit about that and pretty much everything else. Abel James is a best-selling author, musician, speaker, and entrepreneur. He's a modern-day Renaissance man. He's had one of the number one rated health podcasts in more than 8 countries. He's a best-selling author. He has an award-winning web series, The Fat Burning Man, and he's helped millions of people reclaim their health. And he's here to talk to us today specifically about his new book, The Wild Diet, and how it is specifically helpful and can be helpful to women, and about fasting and intermittent fasting and what the difference is for women. So Abel, welcome, and thank you so much for being here.
Thanks so much for having me, Katie.
Awesome. Well, first, I would love if you could tell us a little bit about your story, because I know people to know you now may think that you've always just had perfect, vibrant health. And I know we've talked about your story, so I know that's not the case. But I'd love to hear you tell your journey, and especially the part about losing 20 pounds while eating chocolate.
Yeah, that's the most important part, to be honest. So growing up, I was always really active and into sports and, you know, had my physique kind of under control. But then after getting into adult life, you know, coming out of college, I was working in consulting in Washington, D.C. And if anyone's seen, you know, House of Cards or any political shows, you kind of know what D.C. people wind up looking like. And so, you know, as a lot of lifestyle factors collided with the fact that for the first time in my life, I had good insurance. So I went to go find basically the best doctor I could, because we have a history in my family of thyroid problems and high blood pressure and other things like that. So I figured, while I have this good job, while I have this good insurance, let's you know, try to do everything that we can to preempt any problems that might come up. And so my doctor basically immediately put me on a diet. He said, you know, with your family's history, you should definitely be eating super low calorie, super low fat. And that was the first time that I really started focusing on diet. I had been on and off vegetarian and kind of like interested in food for a long time. But this was the first time that someone kind of like slapped my wrist and said, this is the way you need to eat if you want to be healthy. And so, you know, I was eating a lot of whole grains and things that the doctor said were on the okay list that were low fat or low calorie and mostly just tasted like cardboard. But that I could easily buy at the Safeway that was just a few blocks away. And over the course of time, you know, I'd go in every like couple of weeks and my numbers, you know, I'd pee in a cup and he'd like take my blood and we'd go through everything. And my numbers kept getting worse. And so I kept dieting harder and harder. And then all of a sudden, you know, a few years go by and I'm like 23, 24 years old and I'm 20 to 30 pounds overweight and I look like I'm 40 and, you know, I'm feeling sluggish and I'm just, you know, it happens to so many other people too. I kind of just thought that it was genetics or something that I was destined to be like, you know, as I grew older. But at one point, it was after my boss actually ragged on me for putting on weight and like being fat, that I looked in the mirror and I'm just like, this clearly isn't working. And I've always been really into experimenting on myself and guinea pigging. And so at the same time, one of my older brother actually really got into pumping iron and bodybuilding stuff. And so we had all these like underground bodybuilding textbooks from like the 60s and the 70s. And I read up on high fat diets and eating like a lot of really rich foods and clean foods. And you know, some of those old bodybuilder guys in the 60s that won on their low body fat percentage were eating things like 36 eggs a day and like chugging heavy cream and 2 gallons of milk a day. I mean, absurd. And so I thought, you know, if there's one way to kind of like take away a lot of variables, is changing one diet and doing like almost the opposite thing. So going from low fat to high fat. And about a month later, after I did that, you know, the fundamentals of my diet were pumping up the good fats like grass-fed butter, whipping cream, coconut oil, avocados, things like that. And then ratcheting down the carbs, especially the refined grains and even the whole even the whole grains. And after about a month, I dropped 20 pounds. And even more than that, you know, my body showed all this definition, almost like a bodybuilder. And I was so like shocked by how easy and straightforward it was to get away from something I'd been trying so hard to do. You know, like dieting is hard and eating food that you don't like is terrible. So this was basically the best thing I ever did. And I never really turned back after that.
Yeah. That brings up a really interesting point because I've been thinking about this a lot lately. And especially I get a lot of questions on my site from people who are struggling with hormone imbalances or trying to lose weight. And I've always thought, you know, we always, people who are trying to lose weight, we're looking at you know, different diets and different weight loss plans, but those are geared for people who are heavier and who are having hormonal problems. Whereas if you want to look at people who actually have gotten it right, look at bodybuilders, because certainly, you know, not everything they do is healthy, but they've at least been able to dial in on that. So yeah, what else can we learn from the bodybuilding mentality? And are there any cautions there?
Well, I think it's, you know, it wasn't just bodybuilding. That was just kind of like an extreme example that kind of like shocked me into trying something completely different. But, you know, to be honest, I've been an athlete for a long time, like a runner, never an elite one, but always, you know, fairly good. And so it was a matter of performance too. And looking at how you fuel your body has a totally different effect on how fast you are, if you're looking at performance type stuff, and also how healthy you are, how often you get sick, how good your immune system is. So you really need to be looking at your hormones, because that's what your physique is all about, is getting your hormones under control. So if you're under eating for a period of time and you're sedentary, that's actually not all that much different from running a lot or like doing a lot of endurance stuff and under eating also. You start to screw up the same hormones. Leptin and ghrelin go all of whack, all out of whack, which are basically the hunger and then the satiating hormones. And so what you want to do in order to lose weight is basically get your health under control first. Make sure your body is operating efficiently, using the right fuels correctly. And everyone kind of runs on their own unique things. Like for me, I don't do well with olives. My mom doesn't either, for whatever reason. But as opposed to some other people who have trouble with milk and dairy, I've never really had a problem eating high quality, especially fermented, grass-fed, pastured dairy. And I have quite a lot of it. So it's all about kind of making sure your body is getting the right nutrients, so that your hormones can do what they're supposed to do, which are, you know, when you're actually hungry and when you need nutrients, you start to crave things like kale or green veggies or rich fats, as opposed to, you know, the junk chocolate that a lot of people eat. You crave the real stuff that has minerals in it. You know, the single origin stuff is just the best. And it's a shame, but there are so many, especially Americans, who have never tasted so many of these foods. Like, people say that they're chocoholics, but most of the chocolate that they eat, you know, the Hershey's and the Reese's and M&Ms and stuff like that, they're made mostly of corn and corn syrup, and they don't really have chocolate in them at all. So when you start to revisit how you look at food, it can really start affecting your body differently.
Absolutely. And that's been a key thing that I found, is shifting that focus, like you said, away from deprivation and dieting, because that's a different mindset and a very stressful mindset. To always be thinking of food as the enemy and just looking at ratios of calories and macros, and because by that logic, you could eat a certain amount of just pure sugar and ice cream and whatever else you wanted every day, as long as it fit within that. And if you look at the people who are those elite fitness professionals or people who are just naturally healthy and fit, they look at food as a fuel. And it's not about how little can I eat to lose weight. It's about how can I actually consume enough to get enough fuel for these activities that I'm doing. And I actually have a relative who, she's now in her 50s, but to keep her bones healthy, she started doing more heavy weightlifting and eating just a very high protein diet. And she looks incredible. She looks younger. She's, you know, squatting 200 pounds. She's deadlifting 500 pounds. Wow. Just amazing. And
isn't that cool?
She talks about how she's like, I can hardly eat enough. Like, I have to eat all day to consume enough to be able to keep this up. And she's not starving herself. She's eating huge amount of healthy proteins and vegetables. And so I always just think that's an important mindset shift that we sometimes miss. And it's so hard in our culture because everything's so about food being the enemy and about deprivation. And so shifting that focus to just nourishment and how can I consume enough nourishing foods, which
food is the best.
Yeah.
You know, the real reason I do this is because we're foodies. You know, we learn to love it as an art form, the cooking as a gift that you can give to the people who you care about and your family. It's so much bigger than what most Americans and the Western world kind of sees food as, which is this thing that will make them fat if they don't pay attention to it. You know, it's like, no, it's man, we never took our food for granted in past generations, you know, and we don't have to go back that far to start to see a really healthy relationship with food. You know, just a generation or two ago, Victory Gardens were in almost every backyard and people were growing their own greens. And, you know, sometimes they'd cook them to death or whatever, but at least they were giving it a shot as opposed to the freeze-dried nonsense that most of us get a lot of times without knowing it when we go to restaurants or eat out. And certainly when we go to the grocery store, the things that they put in there shouldn't even be called food. You know, most other countries won't even import it and sell it as food because it's not even close to the standards. Like what passes for food in America, unfortunately, is something to be afraid of. So that's why it's so important to look at fresh, local sources of real food where the taste comes from the freshness and the quality of the food as opposed to artificial flavorings and preservatives and all this other nonsense that's been blasting our palate for decades now.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think that's a perfect segue into, you have a book coming out and I'd love for you to really delve into what the specifics of it are, but it's called The Wild Diet. And you really advocate a lot of these things, going back to, you know, growing some of our own foods and really incorporating a wide variety of local foods into our diet. So can you talk about what is The Wild Diet specifically and what makes it different?
Yeah. So if you look at most of the food that's available, if we're honest with ourselves, we know that it's not fresh. We know that it's freeze-dried and full of industrial crap. So there's this whole industrial side of food, factory farms, you know, straight out of a horror movie. These poor birds, you know, turkeys and chickens that never get to use their legs. Same thing with cattle and pigs, and they're treated in a way that's totally not humane. They're very sick, so they're pumped full of antibiotics, growth hormones, and they're fattened too quickly. I mean, it really even – I go into when I worked as a consultant, I worked with a lot of Fortune 500s, and in the book I talk about kind of their mentality on where the consumer sits and the concerns of health are so low compared to – you know, how important quarterly profits are. So a lot of this, you know, industrial side of things, it can work really well if you're going to build a car. You know, it's high efficiency. There's a high profit margin. They're very interested in that. But when our health is concerned, it doesn't work too well because we wind up with really low quality food that is designed inherently to be as addictive as possible. And then the marketing that we're subjected to, on top of that is, you know, just driving down a road, you see a hamburger and then you see, you know, chicken nuggets. And then you see this sweet, highly addictive diet drink. And then you see something else. And so like our willpower, it's really tough for us to handle that because it used to be we'd work for our food all day. And then, you know, in the evening, we'd have a big meal and it would be pretty much the highlight of the day. And now we're dodging food all day and usually sitting in a car or sitting in a chair being sedentary. So it's a complete flip of the way that humans are designed to live. So contrast that industrialized view of food with these huge monocrops running on, you know, pesticides and petroleum-based fertilizers and big tractors to a small local farm that grows a wide variety of foods and has animals on that farm that use their own waste as fertilizer to grow nutrient-rich vegetables and fruits. When you get your food fresh and local, it's just better for you and it tastes so much better. And unfortunately, it's getting easier, but it's been really hard in the past few decades to get high quality food in America because the whole food supply chain has changed in favor of enormous companies that care more about shareholder profits and distribution metrics than they do about your health.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love that notion that you have of feasting at night and maybe eating less during the day. And this is something I've actually seen recurring in a lot of, even my doctor talks a little bit about that some. So can you delve into that more? Like what are the benefits of fasting and feasting and how does that work on a practical day-to-day level?
So we always, the whole three square meals a day is really unprecedented when you look at it historically. And when you look at things like breakfast, lunch, and dinner, even when talking to my grandmother about it, it was never like that. On my dad's side, they were dairy farmers. And so a lot of times you would need food to fuel your activity. But on days of rest, like Sunday, say, when they would go to church, they really would undereat throughout the whole day. And then at night, their treat and their dinner would be a big bowl of popcorn that they put like molasses and milk over, which I don't know. I've never heard of milk on popcorn. But, you know, it's just this it's hard to imagine that world because it doesn't exist like that anymore. We're kind of eating all the time. And there are different ways to like if there's no doubt that restricting the amount of food that you eat can help you lose weight and that eating more, especially if the wrong things, can help you gain weight. So in the book, I argue that we're not just eating too much, we're eating too often. And so for me, I found that I actually didn't get hungry until my first meal of the day. You know, every once in a while I wouldn't eat breakfast or I'd just have coffee with some heavy cream in it or something like that. And I'd be like, wow, you know, I actually have a lot of energy. And I started doing that more and then playing around with under eating during the day, which also, you know, I'm very active and love going on hikes and stuff like that. And that's usually how it works. Like you'll take some nuts or maybe some carrots or, you know, an apple, some fresh fruit out in your pack. And then when you come back home or you come back to base camp, you have this big meal and it's just like the highlight of the day and you feast and you really enjoy dinner and you enjoy the ritual of eating and warm food at the end of the day is just the best. So one of the ways that we kind of keep our food down during the day and keep our energy up is by drinking lots of water, drinking tea and coffee, and sometimes nibbling on like raw uncooked food. So it might be a salad or a green smoothie or fruits and veggies, some nuts, something like that. And then we save our big meal and the big preparation of the day. This saves a lot of time too, for the evening hours. And that's actually one thing that if you look at the hormones, your cortisol spikes in the morning. And that's what actually wakes you up, gets you out of bed. When you eat something like refined carbs in the morning or even whole grains, things like bagels, donuts, cereal, bread, pancakes, that sort of thing, as your breakfast, it drives your blood sugar up, which releases a flood of insulin, which makes you hungry in the next couple of hours usually because your blood, the insulin brings your blood sugar back down. You kind of get that brain fog. We all know that, that morning crash. And then you need another cup of coffee. You need some more carbs to keep your energy up all day. If you contrast that to under eating during the day, like this whole week, actually, I'm recording. It's Friday, the last day, but it's been about 7 interviews a day. And my first meal every day has been around between like 4 and 6 p.m. And what I'm eating during the day is basically just teas with a little bit of fat. Sometimes I'll have fish oil as a supplement. And occasionally I'll nibble on a little bit of a salad or green smoothie. And that's pretty much it. And it's amazing the energy that you start to get when you're letting your system – basically digestion is something that's a cost to your system. So during the day, if you want a lot of energy in your brain – then you don't want to eat a big, heavy meal because that's going to pull a lot of your energy down to digestion. So that's where the kind of cloudy-headed, after you overdo it at lunch syndrome kicks in.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. And I've noticed that kind of in my own life as well, that I seem to do better during the day with more just proteins and healthy fats in the morning and you know, green vegetables, light lunch, and then eating a dinner with a family that's obviously bigger because the kids are hungrier, and timing that where it's a few hours before bedtime. So there's time for digestion to happen some, but like you said, when you eat a bigger meal, especially if you're going to have any carbs, having them be healthy sources of carbs and at night, that spikes your insulin, like you said, which does also let your body create more melatonin, which you need for sleep, and reduces your cortisol, which helps you sleep through the night. So I've noticed that's improved my sleep, to really focus on moving healthy carbs tonight and then just keeping my body fueled with protein and healthy fats during the day.
That's been one of the best things about this whole way of eating and living is I used to have a really hard time falling asleep before 10, 11, 12, you know, I'd just be staring at the ceiling tiles, counting sheep, whatever I could, but my sleep quality was poor. And usually I'd have at least an hour or two where I was just trying to sleep. But when I switched to eating this way, you know, having a big meal at night, I mean, you look forward to it all day and it's so satisfying. And then you're totally right. Like the melatonin kicks in and we're, you know, we fall asleep at like 8:30 or 9 and just pass out all night and then wake up early the next day and have really productive mornings. So it's been interesting. Also, we started drinking a lot less, you know, just in terms of our own habits. Sometimes we'd have a glass of wine to help us sleep, even though we kind of know that it hurts in a lot of cases. But having that big meal seems to really make that unnecessary. It seems to make that nighttime thing where you're out of gas and you're tired, but you can't sleep. So you know, go surf the internet or you watch TV or you do something else. We basically get tired before that happens, and nothing good happens after 9 o'clock anyway. So it's good to just pass out instead.
Yeah, for sure. And I'm curious, are there any special considerations with fasting of any kind, especially like this type of more intermittent fasting during the day for women? And I know your wife, Allison, obviously has tons of energy and is very much in shape and fit and healthy as well. But are there any special considerations that she takes with fasting as a female?
Yeah, with females, hormones are even more important than males in a lot of ways, because males are kind of like Jeeps, you know. I think that's a quote from Seinfeld, where for the most part, pretty predictable and pretty resilient in terms of our own bodies, you know, going out and doing a lot of activity without food, or really we seem to respond better to stress in a lot of ways, torturing our own bodies for some reason we can get away with it. And if you look back at, you know, where we came from in genetics and what it was like in caveman days, hunter-gatherer times, that kind of makes sense. But with women, there are so many more concerns with the hormones, because, you know, carrying a child and growing on inside you and then lactating and all of the other things that women uniquely, their bodies need to keep up with, pre-menopause, post-menopause. If you're stressing the body too much in other ways, adding another stressor like fasting isn't often that good of an option. So, for example, if you're not sleeping enough or if you're exercising too much, adding something like fasting to the mix they call it a hormetic stressor or hormesis, where basically you subject the body to a little bit of stress, like under eating but still being active, and the body can heal itself, similar to the way that if you do squats or if you do bicep curls, your muscle will kind of break down, and then when it comes back, it'll come back stronger and more toned. A similar thing happens when you fast. So if you fast too much or if you go too long without food, it can actually backfire for women, because it will spike cortisol and then you'll get more hungry than usual. You'll store more fat. So you really want to listen to your body and start small. When we first started this, we would skip a meal every once in a while. And we eventually just kind of followed our bodies, tried what worked and kept doing that. And eventually it got us to, you know, not all days, like some days I will eat three meals, especially if I'm being really active or something like that. But usually that means that I don't eat my first real meal until 3 p.m. or 6 p.m. Sometimes noon will be my first one. And if that's the case, it'll usually be protein, veggies, and usually a bit of fat. But for Allison, she's much more variable. It's like she'll tend to get hungry earlier than I do. Say if I don't feel like eating until 3 or 6, she'll feel like eating at 12 or maybe even 10. And so it's really important to honor that. And if you're feeling stressed and you feel like you need some brain food, or that you're just running on overdrive, or that you didn't sleep that well, you can tell that you're stressed out. It's really important to get some high quality food in there. So you can never go wrong eating green leafy veggies or a big salad. You know, that's something that whenever you're craving it, follow your hunger and eat. But don't go for the pancakes. You know, don't go for the sandwiches and the subs and the carb heavy things, because that just puts you on this roller coaster that makes you want to keep eating.
Yeah, definitely. And I'm glad you brought up stress, because I love that you guys are kind of living off grid right now and traveling the world. And I'm curious, what has that taught you guys about turning off and unplugging and stress? And have you noticed any physical changes just from doing that?
Absolutely. Everyone knows the phantom phone vibrations in their pockets or purses or whatever. And what we did actually was kind of neat. In June, we lived in Austin for like the past 6 years. And we sold our house, our cars, pretty much all of our stuff. And actually, a lot of our technology, since we were flying international, wouldn't work anyway. So we just basically declared technological bankruptcy on social media and on email. We put up vacation messages and basically said, you know, we're in Indonesia right now. We don't even have internet, but we'd love to hear from you soon or connect with you later. And it's really hard to notice how stressful this culture is, this technologized culture where everyone has several devices that are bleeping and blooping at them all day. It trains you to be reactive. It trains you to kind of like follow the day around, whatever comes up, and address that in these kind of like 5 to 10 second little chunks, and never actually get a hold of what you want to do that day, what's important to you, spending quality time with your friends and family. And so unplugging has been one of the best things we've ever done, because basically it was like a few weeks of being off of email. And then, you know, we came back and looked at it a little bit, and I realized that 90% of those emails were just noise, and almost all of those texts were unnecessary, and a lot of the voicemails were too. And what we really learned to value while we're, you know, living in the woods or visiting family or just, you know, spending time in cultures that are totally foreign to us, is that being in the present without technology is like one of the best gifts you could ever give to anybody. So when I'm hanging out with my dad, I'm not on my phone. You know, like we're going to dinner, no phones allowed. We grew up in the middle of nowhere in New Hampshire where phones didn't work anyway. So like that side of my family is kind of used to it. But, you know, at the beginning, it wasn't easy, because I had an okay time doing it, but it's the other people in your life who were even more addicted to their technology than you are, who are really bummed out when all of a sudden you're not responding to 17 texts a day and you're not responding to every email. But I think we all kind of need a hearty dose of truth, which is that there's no way we can ever keep up with all of this. Like there's a new social network every week that we need to, you know, start and then nurture and learn how to use to keep up with everybody. And it's just, it's getting out of hand.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I think that the idea of fasting could really be applied to technology just as much as food. And we'd probably all benefit from that. One of my big things that I always am recommending is, especially just turn it off at night and let that be family time. After sunset, don't use the computer. Don't look at your phone. Don't watch TV if you can help. And if you do, wear orange glasses or use only orange light bulbs, or just give your body that time to be away from technology.
It's important. You sleep so much better. But you know, it's really neat. I'll just share a story of hanging out with my brother, Mark, who works on an organic farm, and he's been living that lifestyle for a while. He's never really gotten that into technology. And there's such a fascinating thing that happens when you like hang out at this old farmhouse with him and his girlfriend and you don't have TV and you don't have phones, because you wind up just like playing card games with each other and talking and listening to Tom Waits records and stuff. And you feel like you're back in the like 50 years ago. But were they happier then? Were they as stressed as us? I would venture a guess that they weren't as stressed as us. Certainly not in the ways that we're stressed now, which are the unnecessary ones, right? Like we used to be stressed by things like survival or dying from disease. And that's such a secondary concern now that we're stressing about like not getting back to someone who texted us 2 minutes ago. So yeah, fasting from technology, especially with your family at night, like bring back family game night, bring back one of my best memories from being a kid, was we got like 2.5 channels in New Hampshire. And anytime we wanted to change the channel, my dad would have to climb up on the roof and move the antenna around. We'd be like, oh no, right there. So one of the channels that we got halfway was channel 13. And every Saturday night we'd watch Star Trek The Next Generation as a family and make pizza together as a family. And even though pizza is one of the worst foods you can eat from a health perspective, it was one of like the culture of it, you know, all of us getting together, putting our fingers in the dough, laughing, spending quality time. And then, you know, making our own pizzas was a big part of it too. So like being a kid and being allowed to like, you know, put cheese in the crust or like make a double decker pizza and just experiment with food is something that makes you fall in love with it. Even if it's, you know, a stepping stone to eventually eating a big salad.
Absolutely. And I'd love to transition a little bit. I know there are probably a lot of moms listening who have kids, and I'm curious about this myself as well. You were involved with a book called The Musical Brain, which was also a bestseller. And I know that people may not know this as much about you, but you're a musician as well, and you've actually just recorded an album from what I've heard. But I'd love for you to talk about that, your research that you've done with music and the brain, and especially for those of us who are moms, how can we implement this with our children at a young age to help them?
Music is a language, and it's one that comes, we don't know why we have music, right? Like it's very bizarre how much it's everywhere, but there's no real like evolutionary adaptive reason for it that's obvious anyway. But music is something that deeply affects the brain and helps grow certain parts of the brain in a way that almost like no other art or no other thing does. It's essential for communication. You know, there was a really neat study that I mentioned in my book about when women, when mothers talk to their babies, they try to emote a bunch of different feelings. So happy, sad, and basically a bunch in between. And so with their voices, they try to communicate that with words. And they did this for a bunch of different babies at different ages. And then they sang those emotions. And by several multiples, the babies could understand the emotions from maternal singing, from the singing of mothers, but they couldn't from the words. And I think that's something that really applies a lot to all of us. When you listen to someone speak, it really has nothing to do with the words, right? It's more about the feeling behind the words. And so when you learn music as an art and you start to play it, you learn how to communicate better. And you also, like, this is something that's really important to me, and this is how I start the book. When I was a kid and a teenager, I had to go through some really rough things. And one of my best friends, my cousin, died in a freak car accident. And I couldn't get myself to cry, even though, you know, he was my best friend. And I knew that I needed to have some sort of outlet. And so the only thing that I could do to kind of open that up and cope was turn on my amplifier and play guitar as fast and as hard as I could, you know, trying to keep up with crazy people like Jimi Hendrix and Stevie Ray Vaughan. And I would just play until I collapsed, literally in tears. And then it would just open up all of these emotions and you could deal with them. And then I would write songs about it. And so I am very honest about the fact that at many points in my life, music has saved my life. So one of my great passions is getting kids to love it because it's not hard, you know, but most people teach music wrong, which is like, you know, slapping your wrist and saying, you need to practice, you need to practice. And it's more about kind of having, we didn't have cable TV growing up or all these distractions of technology. What we had was like this dinky little $5 Yamaha keyboard that we got at a yard sale that we'd plunk around on, and this little tape recorder that we made radio shows on. And look at me now. I mean, like, I'm a musician and a radio show host, and it's so cool to kind of look back at that. And I'm so thankful because we never had much money, but we always had cool little musical toys around. And I think that's, if anything, you don't need to stress out about like making sure your kids play. Just like keep those things around and offer it to them, you know, say like, hey, that little guitar looks like fun. let's learn a few chords or something.
That's fascinating. I was definitely taught more of the slap on the wrist, you need to practice type of way with piano. And I still, like part of me loves piano and loves music, but a part of me just doesn't like to play because that brings back those memories. Are there different types of music that are better to, like if a child's showing an interest, to encourage, or different instruments that are better, or is it really specific to a child?
It's so, everyone is so unique. And I think everyone has a thing, you know? So for me, I always loved the saxophone, and that's my, you know, in a lot of points in my life, that's been my main instrument. Now I play guitar and sing, and I do a lot of other things, but those were the things that really like appealed to me. And then my other brother, Mark, he was always a drummer, you know, and he's like a typical drummer, kind of like flighty and spastic, but like tons of energy and really good at that. So, you know, he was always banging on pans and I was always plunking on something with a melody. I think that you need to just find whatever resonates with your kid, because we tried to do piano lessons. I went twice, I think, and I hated it because the teacher, you could tell she never played piano and she didn't like it. And she didn't, you know, and that's no way to learn. It's more about like trying to create music and create sound. And even like having a piano there that your kid can put their fingers on and hear a sound come out does something in terms of really good training for them and training the brain, especially when kids are really young. They're looking for all sorts of different stimuli. So I wouldn't get your kids started on death metal or anything like that. There are a few types of music that are dark and they're obvious. But basically everything else that has a melody, getting your kids to sing is so easy. You know, you don't even need to buy an instrument, but making an excuse to be a little bit more musical and get involved with music is one of the best gifts you could ever give to yourself and your family.
Yeah, I'm really curious to see how this will play out with our kids, because we have five, as you know, and my youngest, when I was pregnant with her, I was on this like Italian opera and like old fashioned opera kick and classical music. And cool. To this day, she's almost two. And she can be in the middle of like a full out temper tantrum and I can put on like Andrea Bocelli and she just completely mellows out.
Isn't that amazing?
We had a piano. It was my husband's grandfather was a maestro and he taught piano and violin for years, and his piano was recently passed on to us. And so she's always had it to play on. And I found it fascinating that she's from the beginning had this intense interest in music. And she also was our earliest talker and our earliest walker. And even now she's talking full sentences, but she can sing more than she can talk, and she'll sit at the piano and just belt it out. And so I'm really curious to see how that evolves as she grows.
And I've seen the other end of that too. People who, you know, with Alzheimer's, I've been with a few of them who have lost the faculty of speech. They can't really communicate that way anymore, but they can, if you sing a song that they knew, for example, from childhood, they can sing, and they can sing every word, and they remember all the melodies. There are a lot of really neat YouTube videos. If you just Google something like that, it'll come right up. But it's some of the most beautiful things to see, just how it's almost like it's coming straight from their heart. It bypasses the brain in all ways, but it's a very emotionally rich experience. So it's amazing for kids, but it also keeps you alive a lot longer too. This is like a running joke amongst musicians that if you don't die of a drug overdose when you're like 27, then you pretty much live forever. I mean, they'll cart those old guys, like especially the old blues guys down in Austin. They still had a bunch of them. They'll cart them out on stage and, you know, they've been 400 pounds for 40 years or whatever, but they're still rocking it on guitar in their 80s and 90s. And it's just such a cool thing. It keeps you alive. And there are a lot of physiological reasons for that too. Just I'm a big fan of Qi Gong and Tai Chi and movements that kind of calibrate your brain with your visual part of the brain, basically with the physical. So if you're looking at your hands move, or you're putting your fingers down on keys and sounds are coming out, that's really good for keeping yourself sharp and keeping your nervous system in order, especially as if you want to age well.
That makes so much sense. And out of curiosity, what is the album you just finished? Is that something we're going to be able to get in stores?
Yeah. It's so nuts because my show, my podcast, without me knowing, a lot of like celebrities started listening to it. And one of them was some of the guys from the Tim McGraw band. And so we got together and started jamming, and it was so much fun. We accidentally recorded an album in Nashville. We didn't really know what we were going to be recording, but came out with like a dozen songs and wrote a few on the spot. And it's so much fun. So it's I think we're going to call it Swamp Thing, and it should be coming out this spring. But we're going to release it like completely independently of record companies and stuff like that, because these days it's much more fun to be independent and kind of just like let your music speak for itself, I think.
Oh, for sure. Well, and to kind of wrap it up, I want to respect your time, but there's three questions I always ask at the end. And the first is, if someone's just starting out and they feel really overwhelmed, what would be the three baby steps you would give them to get started?
There's so much misinformation out there, and so it's really hard to know what to do. But if there's one thing that basically every health expert agrees about, it's that we should all be eating more green leafy vegetables. So do that every day. It's something that we do almost every meal, actually. So that's the real secret. It's not protein, fat, carbs, or anything like that. It's really just getting your veggies in and staying away from, in any large quantity, the starchier veggies. I'll make this number two. Stay away from things like refined grains. Definitely stay away from sugar, even in the form of fruit and fruit juice, which oftentimes has 50, 100 grams of sugar if you buy it off the shelf. And even if you're making smoothies at home or whatever, using something like berries, which is a tart, low sugar fruit, pretty much all berries are like that, compared to like a pineapple, tropical fruits are too sugary to be good for you in any quantity. They're more like toppings. And then number three, be active. You don't have to do a, you know, huge workout every day. In fact, one of the things that I do, I broke my foot this past summer, and so I couldn't do pretty much any of my exercises. So I had to get really into staying in shape by being balanced and doing the more low impact type stuff like Qigong and like Tai Chi or yoga or Pilates and that sort of thing. So what I do is 6 days a week, I exercise for about 2 to 5 minutes. That's all. And so if you can do a 2 minute exercise that gets your blood pumping, or even just a little short jaunt outside, that's something. Don't think that you always have to go to the gym if you want to work out. Just do a few push-ups, do a few air squats, whatever it is. Get your blood pumping every day. The morning is the best time to do that. So take 2 minutes tomorrow morning and get started.
Awesome. And a favorite book or resource besides your own?
Oh boy, that's good. I would have to say all of the recipes on the internet. And here's why, because like basically anything with real food in it, you know, that's gluten-free or grain-free or totally paleo or grass-fed or whatever, you can just open up your phone and Google it and it'll spit back, you know, like 10 recipes, and most of them are probably pretty good. So whatever you like know that dish can probably be made healthy out of real food. So that's, yeah, use that. I mean, just there's so many people, I don't know what to make today, but we have, you know, the entire world in our pockets. So take advantage of that.
Yeah. Great point. And then finally, what do you wish someone had told you earlier in life?
Every kick in the butt is a step forward. Learning from failure is one of the best things you can do. So planning on it is pretty cool. So it helps you seeing failure as something that you can use to your own advantage later, is pretty cool, but it takes some time and some getting used to see it that way. And it's, you need to constantly remind yourself every day that there will be roadblocks. There will be things that go wrong, but you're probably eventually going to be better off for them.
Awesome. And Abel, where can people find you online?
Best place to find me right now is wilddietbook.com. And we're doing a bunch of giveaways for, putting this book out there. And basically the book is like we made it to be a cookbook, with awesome recipes that's surrounded by a bunch of stories, and tidbits from all these different food cultures around the world. So if you're interested in the book, it's wilddietbook.com. And, if you like podcasts and shows and stuff like that, then mine's called Fat Burning Man, and I'm not too hard to find.
Awesome. And when does your book officially release?
April 7th.
Awesome.
Coming right up. It's crazy.
Those bonuses are available, I'm guessing, until it releases, so people can get those now?
Yes. Actually, we're giving away a drone for HD filming and GoPros and a bunch of cooking gear and my favorite skillet and other fun stuff like that. So yeah, it's going to be cool.
Awesome. I need to go enter that too. Awesome.
Totally. Abel,
thank you so much. Please tell Allison hi, and thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you, Katie, and thanks for listening.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Wellness Mama Podcast, where I provide simple answers for healthier families. If you would like to get my 7 Simple Steps for Healthier Families guide for free, head on over to wellnessmama.com and enter your email, and I'll send it over to you right away. You can also stay in touch on social media, facebook.com/endlesswellness, or on Twitter and Instagram at wellnessmama. And I would also really appreciate it if you would take a second and subscribe to this podcast so that you'll be notified of future episodes. And if you've ever benefited from something I talk about on this podcast, I would be really appreciative if you would leave a rating or review, since that's how others are able to find this podcast and so we can help spread the message. Thanks as always for listening and for reading and for being on board with creating a future for our children that's healthier and happier. And until next time, have a healthy week.